Welcome to the Smichael Speaks podcast channel. I'm Joanne Smichael, and I'm delighted that you tuned in for relevant leadership learning that will help you continue to soar. Enjoy this episode. Dr. Joyce Lee Iannotti is back. She is here to help us understand the relationship between sleep and brain-body health. Welcome, Dr. Lee Iannotti.
Thank you, Dr. Smichael. It's so great to be back.
You've got really impressive credentials in neurology and specifically in sleep medicine. You've earned a national reputation, a laudable national reputation. You're the vice chair of the sleep division of the American Academy of Neurology, director of the Sleep Medicine Fellowship Program Directors Council, sponsored by the American Thoracic Society, and you're on the board of directors for the American Academy of Sleep Medicine Foundation. So obviously you care a lot about sleep medicine. It's your passion. And I know you've got a real particular interest in the connection or the relationship between sleep and brain-body health. What drew you to that? What made you want to focus on this brain-body sleep connection?
Absolutely. Well, you know, as a neurologist, I'm probably about 12 years in practice now, with training before that. You know, it was very early recognized that we have devastating neurological disorders that we still don't have cures for. So things like Parkinson's disease, which is like diabetes of the motor control centers in the brain, very slowly progressive, and people ultimately die of debilitating diseases. Other diseases like Lou Gehrig's disease, like stroke, like Alzheimer's dementia. These are all things that we have been researching, we have been studying for very long periods of time, and we don't quite have a cure yet. Although I want to remain optimistic, that's in the forefront. So what really compelled me was, if we are diagnosing these horrible disorders, counseling patients that you have this horrible disorder, but now that the process has started, it's really just making your life comfortable. And that's all we have to offer. I started to really appreciate the impact of preventative medicine. And that's where we start early. And we look at things that we can do to change our brain health, how our brain ages, slow down that aging process, and prevent the development of these horrible neurological diseases. So Joanne, I read a statistic the other day, and for Parkinson's disease, and this is true for Alzheimer's too, in 2050, they anticipate 40 billion people worldwide. 40 billion. And we know not only, gosh, I mean, how that affects the patient, their caregivers, their family, but just the impact on society, financials, just the overall society picture just really was like disheartening to me.
That's so distressing. That is really distressing.
Horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Horrible. Yeah. Well, thanks for that downer, Joyce.
I'm sorry. I know.
It's okay. Oh. It's okay. So you talk about sleep and brain health. Dr. David Dodick, the chair of the American Brain Foundation, was on talking a little bit about brain health. And tell me, well, actually, he hasn't been on yet. He'll be on soon. So tell me, what when you say brain health, what do you mean? And then make the tie for me between sleep and brain health.
Sure. Okay. So I'm so glad to hear that you're going to have Dave Dodick as a speaker. I'm going to tune in for sure for that, because that's going to be amazing. But when I think of brain health, I think of the brain's overall well-being and optimal functioning of the brain, just like the body. And so it's very multifaceted. It has cognitive function. It's your emotional well-being. It's the ability to cope with stress. And this overall impacts your physical health, your quality of life, and longevity. So as a neurologist, I'm going to say the most important organ in your body is the brain, not the heart, which I think is true. And so where sleep comes into play, and this is all pretty relatively new literature, Joanne, that shows that sleep can predate horrible neurological disorders. So I'm going to give you two examples, and these are like the hot topic in sleep. So one, I'm going to start with Parkinson's disease, and this is kind of my research niche, where we find that 10 to 20 years before people start developing signs of Parkinson's, they start acting out their dreams in REM sleep. So in REM sleep, when you and I are in REM sleep and we don't have REM sleep behavior disorder, where our minds are active, we're actively dreaming, but the way the brain is built in the brainstem, our body is paralyzed, which is a feature that keeps us kind of safe, right? But people with RBD, at some point, they're actively dreaming. They could be dreaming that there's a bear chasing after them, and they will run out of their bed straight into the wall, straight out of a window. So this is dysfunction at the brain level that predates the development of Parkinson's by 10 to 20 years.
Wow.
And I'm going to put that in a different statistic that's a little bit easier to kind of digest, but harder to hear at the same time. So when I see a REM sleep behavior disorder patient, and they're typically patients in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and on, based on the current literature, if there's not a secondary cause like sleep apnea or medications that are causing their dream enactment, I have to sit them down and tell them, the literature shows me that you have a 90% chance of developing Parkinson's in a decade.
That's heartbreaking. That's heartbreaking. So let's say you get that horrible diagnosis. Can sleep help prevent the onset? Tell me, what can sleep do once you're already telling me that I've got this death now?
Yes. So with Parkinson's, it's still in like the research realm. And so I do want to say that we haven't found like a sleep method that is necessarily curative for Parkinson's. But based on the research that we've done, we are in the works as a field of finding a neuroprotective agent that slows the deposition of the abnormal protein called synuclein. And our thought is, if we can target these patients who haven't developed Parkinson's yet, but have all the red flags and start them on a neuroprotective agent, then it could prevent the development of Parkinson's.
Ah, so that's current research?
That's current research.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very, very interesting. Research that you are involved in personally?
Yes. Okay. Yes. People much smarter than I are actually developing the drugs. And this is an international campaign that goes US, Italy, Europe, China, everywhere, but it is a global effort to thwart the trajectory of Parkinson's, which is super exciting.
That is exciting. That is very exciting. So we know that sleep impacts Parkinson's and other diseases. How about mental illness?
That's
things like depression, anxiety disorders. What's the tie-in to sleep?
Yes. So we know that poor sleep can trigger anxiety, depression. We know that anxiety, depression can be exacerbated by poor sleep. It ends up becoming a very vicious cycle. So, Joanne, I saw a statistic recently that said that 75% of people with depression and anxiety are poor sleepers. 75%. And it becomes this vicious cycle because when you're already depressed, you're anxious. And that's, remember, a neurotransmitter problem. And then you feel fatigued and exhausted. It just compounds everything and makes everything feel worse. It sabotaging, you know, antidepressants and anxiety medications and their effects. So it's this vicious cycle that continues. There's a lot of data that shows that ongoing insomnia can increase a person's risk of depression by really weakening their emotional reserve and their resilience. And we know the harmful effects of that. So again, it's not really like a behavioral issue at this point. There are a lot of genetic factors, neurotransmitter abnormalities with serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, and then even objective proof in the sleep lab that people with anxiety and depression just have very fragmented sleep. They're waking up a lot. They're not getting a lot of REM and deep sleep. And so it really goes hand in hand. And I think treating both of them. So not only helping people get better sleep, either through medications or cognitive behavioral therapy, and then maximizing on their medications for depression, anxiety, and more ideally finding medication that helps with both is our ultimate goal.
So do you partner with a lot of psychologists and psychiatrists so that it's kind of wraparound care to help people?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I want to emphasize the fact that sleep medicine is a very multidisciplinary field.
Okay.
So I'm a neurologist, we have pulmonologists, we have internal medicine, family medicine, but a big part of our field is psychiatry and psychology.
Okay.
So they are our colleagues and we work as a team to find solutions for our patients. So if I'm seeing a patient with insomnia and really refractory, horrible depression, I will actually pick up the phone and call the psychiatrist. We will have this kind of collaborative discussion about how we can best treat the patient. I acknowledge the fact that I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm not going to know how to manage bipolar and anxiety and depression like he or she would. So I love this open discussion where we can come up with a regimen that makes sense for both their mood disorder and sleep.
I love that. I love that you're in partnership with other physicians. That's excellent. 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 So we've talked about the fact that, you know, sleep impacts everything, our ability to think, learn, remember. But I want to talk a little bit more about the body and the physical health and how sleep impacts that. I can say for me, I know when I miss my 7-hour mark, I do feel sluggish. And I don't feel as I'm a pretty high energy person. I don't feel that. So what else does it do to our bodies, to our physical health?
Yeah, great question. And so I'm going to kind of break it down into short term versus long term.
Okay.
So, you know, short term effects, like, you know, if we go to Vegas, you and I go to Vegas and we stay up a little bit late for a weekend, we're going to feel pretty bad for a few days. And it's going to be low energy, backaches, fatigue, kind of our mood is off. We may be more irritable. But, you know, in the short term, you can kind of chase it and you can fill that cup back up and you'll be okay. The short termers, you know, who are doing marathons and staying up all night, I don't worry about so much. It's really the chronically sleep deprived people who are leaving this for years and decades and living their life like with a half empty tank, or like almost an empty tank. And it's those people where the damage may not be so reversible. Mm-hmm. And so I hope I can talk about something that is really cool. It's actually a new research finding, and it's based on the glymphatic system.
Okay, talk about it.
So the glymphatic system is a recently discovered waste clearance mechanism in the brain that operates maximally in sleep. So I wish I could show you this picture. I'm going to send you a picture of it, Joanne, but somebody drew a pictorial representation of these little people with brooms and a vacuum cleaner and shovels, and they're shoveling these abnormal piles of bad protein in your brain at night, and the person's eyes are closed, so they're sleeping. So even in a normal person, without Alzheimer's, without mild cognitive impairment, without genetic factors for Alzheimer's, to right now, you and I are building amyloid and tau proteins in our brain because we're using it. It's the exotoxins that are building up. But when you and I hit our heads, hit the pillow, those little men come and they start cleaning away. And this makes me really happy because I am an OCD cleaner. So I love that concept. But it's people who are chronically sleep deprived, where those little people cleaning out their system are only working like 10% of the time. And so you can imagine these landfills and piles of abnormal protein that build up and build up and build up. And when you look at on pathology slides, they're actually plaques and tangles that are building up inside your brain. And I mean, the literature shows that these people are at 3 to 4 times higher risk of developing Alzheimer's dementia.
Oh, that's so sad. So yeah. It does affect the body. It does.
It does affect, yes. And chronic sleep deprivation, there's a beautiful diagram I show my patients too. I do a lot of scaring of my patients, I realize, Joanne, in the room. But, you know, it gives them one, I think it gives them that sense that this is really important, because there's still this sense like, oh, sleep is, you know, it's an afterthought. You know, it's something like a luxury that you get. But the truth is it takes a toll on your body. It's like our bodies are our cars. And we know that our cars start sounding funny and they don't work as right at like the 10, 20 year mark. And, you know, we want to live until our 80s and 90s. But if you don't maintain your car, it's going to putter out sooner. So there's been increased risk of cardiac disease, cancer, death, mental illness, neurological disorders, all of those things associated with chronic sleep deprivation.
Wow. Wow. It sounds like you just kind of terrorize your patients, Dr. Lee Iannotti. Jeez
I'm
Louise.
Sorry. I know. I know. It's not fun, but it truly comes from a place of caring and trying to convince that person that this is the time to make the change.
Change. So when I think about sleep disorders, there are only two things that come to mind: insomnia and sleep apnea. Are there any more?
So many more. So many more. Those are the most common. And I think those are the most prevalent. So they're most highlighted. But we see other like really fascinating things, Joanne. Like we see parasomnias. So I've mentioned the REM sleep behavior disorder where people act out their dreams. In kids, we see sleep talking, sleep walking. We see night terrors. My son is going through night terrors right now. He's 8 years old and he'll wake up like screaming, but he's fast asleep. We see nocturnal seizures. We see restless leg syndrome where people have discomfort in their legs. We see some really kind of cool, but really fascinating stuff like headbanging syndrome, or even things that are even more serious at like the legal level. So we've seen like homicidal and suicidal cases, Joanne, that are related to like sleepwalking behavior.
Wow. Wow. That's very interesting. Very, very interesting. It's so funny because I remember watching, I don't know, 2020, 48 Hours, one of those shows, and some guy got up in the middle of the night and killed his wife. And the specialists were saying, you know, the medical experts were saying, this is a real thing. And I thought, you're right. But it's a real thing, huh?
It can be a real thing. So I know the case you're talking about because it happened here in Phoenix years and years ago. So this guy ended up drowning his wife in the pool, blamed Zolpidem, which is the sleeping medication. And it turned out he went to, you know, the hardware store, had bought all of the things that he used days before. This was completely premeditated. So he's still sitting in prison, Joanne. And the other comment I want to make is Rosie O'Donnell was in that also controversy where she made a horrible racist comment and blamed Zolpidem. She's just racist. I'm sorry. It had nothing to do with sleep and Zolpidem. So we do have to be careful because I think that there is that slippery slope of blaming things that are in sleep and subconscious, but that's not always the case. And that's where a lot of investigative work with like sleep studies and evaluation come into play.
Which brings me to another question. So how does a person know if they have a sleep disorder? I've heard people say, I've had a sleep study, and someone I know got this home sleep study where they had a contraption that they had to wear for, I guess, 3 nights. So how do I know I have a sleep disorder? And what's this sleep study stuff?
Okay. So I would say, you know, one, most of my patients, when they come, they're like, my bed partner or spouse or significant other made me come. And the reason is because of things like snoring or stoppage of breathing, which then disrupts the bed partner. So that's like the number one reason. If somebody is telling you you're moving a lot in sleep, you snore, you stop breathing, that's the first sign that you should go see a sleep specialist. But for people who sleep alone, you know, the big thing right now is what we call, I hate the term, but it's sleep divorce, where people are sleeping separately. Cameron Diaz is really all about it. And she's getting the best sleep now that she has her own bedroom. You know, I think that the clues that you can take to yourself is if you just wake up after 6-7 hours of sleep and you still feel like, gosh, I just feel gross. Like, I don't feel good. And I wish I could sleep in a little bit more. That's usually a good sign. There are other signs, like I tell my patients, if you wake up and your sheets are completely disheveled, that's a sign that you're moving a lot in bed and your body is not happy and rested. So something is going on. But I would just say the general sense that I don't have a lot of energy, I think I'm getting good sleep, have a really low threshold to just talk to your primary care doctor, maybe see a sleep physician. The sleep study is helpful, but a lot of times it starts with the consultation and just talking about your sleep and teasing it out.
Okay. And is there an age cohort that is most likely to have sleep disorders?
I'm going to be honest with you. I think it's teenagers and young adults.
Really?
Yes. The prevalence of sleep disorders, and I blame this all on electronics.
Okay.
Not specifically Apple, but but electronics and Netflix and things of that sort. So we have seen this huge increase in consultations for insomnia in young people. The pandemic, of course, made it all the worse because that was really tough, ongoing, but 4+ year period of time where everybody's routine got disrupted. So I worry the most, I'm going to be honest, about the young people, teenagers, adolescents, and young adults.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. What kinds of interventions do you offer them?
It's really, we have, it's, there's so many treatment options now. And it really depends on the disorder at play. But what is really cool about science, Joanne, and this is what I love, is when I did training, you know, over a decade ago, we had like a handful of treatments for sleep apnea. So for sleep apnea, I was like, you can use this machine or you can lose weight. And that was it. Now, you know, fast forward, and this is still in the works, CPAP machine, different modalities, hypoglossal nerve surgery, which is a elective kind of non-invasive surgery to move the tongue out of the way. Weight loss through medications like the GLP-1 agonist, for example, which I think is going to change the trajectory of metabolic syndrome and sleep disorders and sleep apnea. We have medications for sleep apnea that are in the works that are going to be probably commercially available in a year or two. This makes me happy. I'm a sleep apneic. I wear a machine. I don't love it, Joanne, but I feel the benefits. So my migraines went away. I have more energy. I use it because I would be a huge hypocrite if I didn't. But the prospect of other treatments coming out, like a retainer device, we call it an oral appliance, medications, I'm all for it. Some, because we understand that one shoe does not fit all.
Is there any additional advice or even any additional hope that you want to offer to someone who's really struggling with sleep?
Yeah. You know, I think the take home point for me is this is something that is completely modifiable. This is something that can improve. It takes some work. It has to be a partnership with a medical person, a psychologist, and that person to really make a commitment. So I don't want people to go home thinking, hey, I'm going to make the change on my own tonight and I'll be set. So it does require help. There are apps that are available on the phone that are free, but it does require some personal kind of counseling and coaching. But these are the very few things. If you have a bed, if you have the willingness, you can start this at any point. So I want to empower people. You don't have to be a sleep physician. You don't have to be medical. You don't have to be anybody special to say, I'm going to get some good sleep tonight. This is something that even my 8-year-old can start being committed to. So I really hope that I'm bringing the message that this is low-hanging fruit that will deliver a whole basket of fruit in the future.
I like that. I like that analogy a lot. I like it. I like it a lot. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for a few things. First, for being on this Michael Speaks podcast channel. I appreciate that. But thank you also for being a world-changing woman who is working so hard to improve sleep for millions and millions of people, not just for your patients, but for all the people who are listening and all the people that you encounter in the world. Thank you for that. It matters, Joyce, and you matter. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smichael. Hearing that from you, I can't tell you how much that means. And my sentiment towards you is maximized 100 times. Everything you do, this podcast, is changing lives every day. And so I really thank you for not only the invitation, highlighting sleep, but all of the amazing things you do in your life as well.
Thank you. You stay well.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. I hope you got tools that you'll actually use and share. Subscribe if you haven't already. I add new and relevant leadership learning all of the time. If you haven't visited the Smichael Speaks YouTube channel, check it out. There's all sorts of new content. All of this is virtual leadership learning that will help you soar.